The front page of today's New York Times carries the obituary of a journalist who gave 50 years of his life to the paper, James Reston. Reston died of cancer Wednesday at the age of 86. The Times obit describes Reston as perhaps the most influential journalist of his generation. He hired and trained many of the Times' best-known writers and served as mentor to many more. Reston started at the Times as a reporter and went on to work as Washington bureau chief, executive editor, and columnist. He retired in 1989 on his 80th birthday. Reston was known to his friends as Scotty, a nickname that he got because he was born in Scotland. I spoke with him in 1991 after the publication of his memoir, Deadline. He started his journalism career as a sports writer for the Associated Press. Now it may seem unusual to go from sports writer to foreign correspondent, but he told me it wasn't so unusual then.
Sports were an addiction in the 20s and 30s, even more so than they are today. That was the days of Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Bill Tilden in tennis and Bobby Jones in golf. And the sports writers were rather models for young kids like myself in the Middle West because we were caught up in this sports thing. And when I look back on it, I have two thoughts. One... It's a wonderful way to begin for a very simple reason, that the audience for sports knows much more about what is being reported than, for example, the audience of politics. If you make a mistake in sports writing, you get a punch in the nose. If you make a mistake in political writing, you get a letter to the editor. There is a great difference between the two for a young guy trying to learn accuracy.
Which was the more compelling reason to be accurate, the punch in the nose or the letter to the editor?
Always a punch in the nose.
Right.
Always a punch in the nose, sure.
Well, you were in England writing about sports when England went to war with Germany, and the New York Times called you and said, look, we need someone in a real hurry to cover the war, and they signed you up. You, of course, had wanted to work for the Times already. Did you feel prepared to make that transition from sports to war?
No, I didn't. You see, that is one of the interesting great differences between my generation and the present generation. We were, the young characters getting out of college in the early 30s during the Depression, before the United States was involved in the world, we were really, truly isolated. We didn't know the languages of the world. I didn't know the difference between the Baltic states and the Balkans. So there was a great... we were not prepared. But, you know, the interesting things about that particular period was that we didn't know we weren't prepared. It was, this was in the days before psychiatrists took over and said, have you found yourself? We didn't even know we were lost. We were that dumb.
You say that when you were Washington bureau chief during the McCarthy years, that McCarthy took advantage of the cult of objectivity. How did he do that?
Well, he did that in a very very cunning and clever way. You see, in those days, you have to realize that in a great diverse country like this, newspapers all over the country could not afford to send correspondents to Washington, let alone to all the capitals of the world. Therefore, they had to rely on the Associated Press and the United Press, and in those days, in the International News Service. These were cooperative news-gathering organizations. But they represented papers of much different political persuasions. And therefore, their tendency was, indeed their rule was, that they put out the news, whatever was said, without comment, without interpretation. Joe McCarthy understood that very well and realized that whatever a senator said, provided he put his name to it, the agencies would carry what he had to say, and he took advantage of that. So that when he said that there were 87 communists in the State Department, the agencies, the news agencies, carried that story. And then when he was challenged, he said, no, he was wrong about that. There were 105 agencies. So they carried that, too. And that gave him a tremendous opportunity to corrupt the whole idea of being fair and objective.
So, in other words, McCarthy felt that he could make any charge he wanted to, and it would get in print
exactly.
Without a reporter trying to investigate whether that charge was true or
exactly.
not.
Exactly.
Do you feel you ever fell for that yourself? Were you able to get around that?
Well, of course, we all fell for it for a while, but eventually we caught up with it.
When you were the executive editor, were there changes you tried to make in the writing and reporting style of the reporters who worked with you?
Well, you see, at that particular point, there was a very interesting problem in the newspapers. The radio had come along and had taken from the newspaper the job of being the first reporter of the news. You're too young to remember the days when I broke in and there was a great story. It was the newspapers that the people relied on it. And little boys ran through the streets at night shouting, extra, extra. That haunting call ended with the radio, because the radio could come in much quicker than we could with the news. Therefore, we had to find a new role, and that new role was to try to explain the causes and consequences of the news. And that was, sometimes we complained about the radio, but the radio did the newspapers a great favor, because we should have been dealing with the causes and consequences long before we had the crisis.
How did you like being executive editor at the Times?
I did not like it because I didn't think I was very good at it.
Why not? What does it take to be good that you weren't?
Well, I was. I didn't want to do it, and second, I wanted to write. I was a writer, beginning and end, and that was where I was happy. And I tried to be both an editor and a columnist. And ended up by being not fair to either one.
You retired on your 80th birthday. Was that your plan, to like do it on your birthday, make it really symbolic?
No, it just seemed a sensible thing to do. You know, as an old sports writer, I know when pitchers begin to lose the hop on their fastball, and when people get tired of them. And so I thought I ought to get out while I was ahead.
James Reston, recorded in 1991. He died earlier this week at the age of 86. This is Fresh Air.